This is Common Sense, a 2020 presidential candidate interview series focused on common sense, federal fiscal policy, the political process, and bipartisan solutions. Brought to you by WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. This program is sponsored by Issue One Action, a 501c4 nonpartisan organization dedicated to fixing America's broken political system, and the Warren B. Rudman Center at UNH Law, providing programmatic and financial support for students interested in exploring careers in public service. I'm Chase Hageman, and I'm joined by my co-host, Paul Steinhauser. We have Democratic Congressman John Delaney joining the show today. Congressman Delaney represented Maryland's 6th Congressional District for 3 terms and decided to run for president instead of a 4th term in Congress. During his time in the House, he was consistently ranked as one of the most bipartisan members. He co-founded Healthcare Financial Partners and founded Capital Source, a Maryland-based commercial lender. With his first startup, the congressman was the youngest CEO on the New York Stock Exchange when his company became publicly traded. In 2004, he was named an Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year, and his businesses have been voted Best Places to Work. He received his law degree from Georgetown and bachelor's from Columbia. After our break, Paul Steinhauser and I will talk to Congressman Delaney about national fiscal policy, the political process, and bipartisanship. We will be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Common Sense. I'm your co-host, Chase Hageman, along with Paul Steinhauser. We're speaking to former Congressman and Democratic presidential candidate John Delaney. Common Sense is sponsored by Issue One Action and the Warren B. Rudman Center. We will be talking to Congressman Delaney about federal fiscal policy, political process reform, and more. Welcome to Common Sense, Congressman.
It's great to be here.
Well, Paul and I are happy to have you on the show, and I thought it might be a good idea for us to kick off the program with a question from one of our sponsors, Issue One Action, and this one's about elections. So each election season, well-funded, at times unknown groups pop up, spend millions of dollars in political advertising to influence our elections. And many would say that the American people have a right to know who's trying to sway their vote. What would you do to increase political transparency and give voters the information they need to make more informed choices?
Two things. So no matter what means of media you advertise on, a Delaney administration will push to require complete disclosure. So if I put one of my ads on television or radio, I have to say it was paid for by my campaign. If people put ads on social media, they don't have to disclose that. I think anyone who sends any kind of political messaging should disclose who pays for it, no matter where it's being delivered. Television, broadcast, social media, podcast, anything. It's the first thing. The second thing I would do is put limits on how much money groups could put into super PACs. So right now, if someone gives my campaign money, all they can give is $2,800. That's the that is a constitutionally permissible cap on the amount of money they can give to my campaign. If they give more than $200, they have to disclose their name and address and their occupation. Super PACs, there's unlimited amounts of money, and there's no disclosure. So I will push to have those same constitutionally permitted limits on their right to free expression, because that's what political advertising is, because the Supreme Court has clearly concluded that limits and disclosure is constitutional. So I'll push for that to happen for super PACs, and I'll push for there to be complete disclosure of the source of the funding of the ad, no matter where it appears, whether it be broadcast or social media.
This isn't necessarily a question from our sponsor, but I'm curious, do you think there should be an increase in the individual contribution level, maybe to encourage people away from something like super PACs?
Well, I would rather put the disclosure on super PACs, to be honest with you. I mean, I think the $2,800 limit is fine. It goes up a little bit every couple of years. So I don't think that's actually a big problem. I think the fact that we allow people to operate in super PACs with no disclosure and no limits is actually the problem. So what you're kind of proposing is the way to fight super PACs is to make the campaigns, if you will, kind of unlimited. And, you know, I think that's a bit of a race to the bottom.
Well, Congressman, hard to believe, but back in 1970, discretionary spending was about 60% of the federal budget. It's a big number because nowadays it's a lot smaller. And over the next 10 years, it's estimated and projected to fall to less than a quarter of the budget. Right. I bring this up because I want to talk about infrastructure. Mm-hmm. Maybe not the sexiest of topics, but a topic that has been coming up over and over again as you and 23 other of your good friends are running for the Democratic nomination.
I'm the only one who mentioned it on the debate stage, by the way.
Well, there we go. There we go. Over last Wednesday night down in Miami. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about it here. I mean, tell me about it. Do you think domestic investments are necessary? And if so, how do you pay for them? I guess that's the most important thing.
Yeah. And you got to pay for things. I'm one of the few people running for president, in my opinion, who not only has workable ideas and shows the American people how I can get them done, but I actually say how I'm going to pay for them. Because I think the debts we're leaving our kids, they're unpayable. And it's immoral what we're doing in many ways. So the problem is the non-discretionary spending, which includes Social Security and Medicare, has obviously grown to be the largest part of our budget. Social Security is easily fixable, right? Because that's actually a system that has largely been funding itself. It has been funding itself since inception. And we can, you and I could fix that system in 5 minutes right here. Medicare is more complicated because Medicare doesn't fund itself anymore. It is heavily subsidized by the taxpayers generally. And that's a decision that we long ago made, and we're not changing that. So what we really have to do is get healthcare costs under control. And I think we can do that. I think it involves a combination of creating a universal healthcare system and also investing in innovation. Because unless we cure Alzheimer's, for example, it's going to consume the entire federal budget. And on disease after disease, we see it destroying people's lives and gobbling up all of our financial resources. Yet we're entering a period right now between computing power and big data where we're on the threshold of transformative advances in life sciences. So as president, I'm going to make massive investments in basic research because I actually think the most fiscally conservative thing to do, plus the morally correct thing to do, is to actually to cure these diseases. And, you know, that's how I think about it. But things like infrastructure, basic research, these are all really important things. And the problem with our budgeting is, unlike a business, where a business kind of looks at two different things. They look at investments and expenses, and they look at them differently. You need expenses, right, to keep the lights on and all that kind of stuff. But other things that you spend money on are actually investments that you expect to have a high return. And we got to start looking at our budgets that way, because things like infrastructure and basic research have very high returns on economic growth. They're very different than expanding the Department of Labor. And I'm not saying sometimes you don't have to expand the Department of Labor, because you do, but it doesn't have the same kind of investment or economic growth returns as investing in basic research and infrastructure. So we have to change government accounting, because right now the way government accounting works is you got to pay for everything the year you incur it. So if you invest in some infrastructure that you know in 3 years will pay itself back and then give you returns for the next 10 years, you have to pay for it the year you spend the money. And that's no way to run a, as they say, that's no way to run a railroad, and it's no way to run a government.
Congressman, you said a lot in the last 2 minutes that I'd like to try and unpack. I mean, you went from domestic investment to Social Security to Medicare, which, good on you. I mean, most people don't talk about the third rail of politics.
Right.
Well, we'll dive into that a little bit. I want to back up and go back.
You'll force me to grab that rail.
Yeah.
And flail around. Dear
life,
with
yeah. No, I want to talk about one of your plans. I really give you an opportunity to explain it and give us a little more detail on it. But you have a $2 trillion infrastructure plan. First, $2 trillion over what period of time?
And 10 years.
10 years. And then you have some ways to pay for it.
Yep,
but
fully paid for it.
Before you get there, can you just break down what the plan is itself?
So the plan has got kind of three parts to it, if you think about it. The first is putting more money in the Highway Trust Fund. That's how we fund most of our transit or transportation, roads, rail, et cetera, projects in this country. It's currently funded by the gas tax. We haven't raised the gas tax since 1992. And so I'm calling for an increase in that so that we have more money going. So that's kind of taking what's working and just putting more money into it. The second thing I do is I call for the creation of an infrastructure bank, which gets capitalized once and then it exists for 50 years and it can provide flexible financing to all kinds of projects, not just transportation, but water, communications, ports, all kinds of things. And it's designed to be a flexible financing tool because there's a lot of important infrastructure projects out there right now that don't fit a current government program. And so it seems to me you need something that's flexible, that can be adaptive to whatever the situation is. And the third thing I do is I call for the creation of a lot of kind of matching grants around climate, around water, rural broadband, et cetera, where the federal government puts up a certain amount of money, provided the states and local government provide some matching funds for specific projects. So those are the three ways we spend the money, if you will. And in terms of how I fund it a couple ways. One, by increasing the gas tax, because, again, we haven't increased it. I actually think it's the conservative thing to do, because if you don't invest in your roads and keep them well maintained, you actually spend more money down the line having to repair them and replace them when you have problems. And so I think it's totally justifiable. And I think there's ways of doing it so that the gas tax will go up when fuel prices or oil prices go down, and the gas tax will go down when they go up. So you kind of smooth it out at the pump so the American consumer doesn't see it. But I also call for an increase of the corporate tax rate. The corporate tax rate used to be 35%, which was too high. It made the United States not competitive. People like myself and President Obama called for the rate to be 27%. We thought that was the rate the United States needed to compete globally. The business community called for it to be 25%. The Chamber of Commerce, the Business Roundtable, they wanted 25. Pro-growth Democrats like myself wanted 27. This last tax cut it to 21. No one even asked for 21. So I want to move it back up to kind of 26, 27, which will generate about $700 billion and go a long way towards paying for this infrastructure plan. And I think that'll keep our corporate tax rate competitive, and it'll allow us to invest in infrastructure. So that's how I get to my fully paid for $2 trillion infrastructure program.
And similar to that, you have a $4 trillion climate change plan.
Yes.
I'm assuming that there's going to be a similar amount of or type of investment to ramp up combating climate change.
Well, the climate change plan is – my plan is very unique.
It's no Green New Deal, I'm thinking.
No. The problem with the Green New Deal, listen, I applaud the energy of the Green New Deal, but the Green New Deal calls for us to get off fossil fuels in 12 years, which is impossible. There's no way of doing it. And I don't like goals that are impossible. It's like when President Kennedy said, let's go to the moon, he didn't say let's go to Saturn, right? He said let's do something that we could do within 10 years. We cannot get off fossil fuels in 12 years. We just don't have enough alternative energy sources. So that's never going to happen. So I like calling for things that are realistic. My climate plan calls for us to get to net zero by 2050. That's what we need to do to ensure that my kids and your kids and everyone's children out there and our grandchildren inherit the world they deserve. So the first thing I do is I put a price on carbon. It's called a carbon fee. It raises the cost of fossil fuel energy sources, makes them less attractive. And Columbia University modeled my proposal to cut greenhouse gas emissions by 92% by 2040. But what's different about my proposal is I take all the money that's raised in this carbon fee and I put it in a lockbox and I give it all back to the American people in a dividend. So what we're really doing is taking money out of one pocket by increasing the cost of fossil fuels related energies, which the American people will have to absorb. And that's why they'll be less attractive, and that's why they'll use less of them. But I take all the money I raise and I give it right back to the American people. So in many ways, it's kind of tax neutral, but it changes behavior. And that approach is a bipartisan approach, which is why when I introduced this exact proposal in the Congress, I had Republicans supporting it. Because it's the only way of getting something big done on climate. All these other people are proposing things that hurt the American worker and don't do anything for them. My proposal definitely increases energy costs. That's why it works, and we have less fossil fuels when it's done. But I take all that money and give it right back to the American people. It never touches the government's hands.
And just to follow up on that, Congressman, why not go the route of giving part of it back in a dividend and the other channeling it towards infrastructure investment?
You know, I have no problem with that, but I'll never get it passed. And I actually want to do things. So Jay Inslee, the Washington state governor, who I like, who's running on climate change, he tried to pass a carbon tax bill in the state of Washington, which is a Democratic state, right? So this is a progressive state. And he proposed, let's put a price on carbon and let's take the money and use it for green energy projects. It went on referendum. It failed by 15 points in a Democratic state. And again, that was an effort to basically deal with climate change in many ways on the backs of workers. Because at the end of the day, and many people don't like to admit this, but if you go to your average American and say, we're going to raise your energy costs, but trust us, we're going to spend the money on some good things. They walk away from the conversation saying, I don't trust you. But if you go to the American people, say, we're going to raise your energy costs and we're going to stick it in this lockbox and you're going to get a dividend, they're fine with that because every American gets the same dividend, which actually means it helps working people. Because your average working folk under my plan, their energy costs will go up less than the amount of their dividend. That's the first thing. The second thing I'm calling for is to increase the Department of Energy research budget. As you can tell, I'm a big believer in investments. We need new battery and transmission technologies to actually get to net zero. I'm calling for the creation of a Climate Corps, which is a national service program, to actually have young people go around and make communities energy sustainable. I'm calling for a continuation of the tax credits on wind and solar and all those kind of things. And then I'm actually calling for something completely new. And this may sound like science fiction, but I want to create a whole new industry called direct air capture. Think of this as carbon vacuums. They are machines that suck CO2 out of the atmosphere. These machines exist. The technology is proven. The National Academy of Sciences just did a whole review on them and confirmed their viability. The problem with these machines is they're really expensive and they're small. But you know why? Because there's never been an incentive for anyone to really scale them up. So I'm going to take the $50 billion of tax credits that we give fossil fuel companies right now, and I'm going to use it for the government to create a market to purchase carbon that is captured from the atmosphere and used productively, which will stimulate a massive new industry because all the venture capitalists, scientists, entrepreneurs, and businesses out there will suddenly start investing in taking these technologies and making them cheaper and scalable, which is exactly what they did with wind and solar when we created the tax credit market decades ago. And this industry, in my judgment, will be launched and will be very big by 2050. 300,000 people will be employed in this industry and will basically capture 20% of the carbon out of the atmosphere, use it and store it productively, and will not only save our country, but will save the world. And in the meanwhile, we'll lead in the what I think will be the most valuable innovation. Because we can't get to net zero by 2050 unless we do this. And this is, again, where I'm honest. Because if you think about how we create CO2, we do it by the production of electricity. We can definitely get that to net zero. We do it through cars. We can definitely get that to net zero with electric vehicles. But the other way we produce CO2 is with airplanes in the sky, big ships that cross the ocean, through farming, and through the manufacturing process. And we have no way of getting those things to net zero. So what we have to do is we have to offset the CO2 those things produce by actually removing the carbon directly from the atmosphere.
So we have to go to break, but I before we do that, I'm really curious.
That was a lot.
It was great. It was a good conversation so far. And this carbon vacuum thing, I don't know, it's probably a more technical name than what I just dumped it down to.
Direct air capture or negative emissions technology. I call them carbon vacuums because people get it better.
So are there any negative consequences to sucking the carbon out of the air? Does it take
you
got to
do something
else
with it.
Does it take anything else out of the air? Like what?
No. Okay. The way it's a simple process, right? It actually, you suck the air across a filter. The CO2 attaches to certain materials in the filters, and these are very complicated things, but I'm describing them simply. And then you have to heat it up, and the CO2 separates, and it goes into liquid form, and you transport it. And then you can store it, right? There's big cavities in the earth you can store it in. You can use it for other fuel. It can be used for all kinds of other extraction technologies. It can be put in sodas, right? I mean, and I'm calling for us to build something called the carbon throughway, which is basically a pipeline in the heartland of the United States. Not a new pipeline. We're going to lay these things in all the existing natural gas right-of-ways. So there'll be no new right-of-ways. I want everyone to understand that. And this way, we'll locate this industry in the heartland of the country where we need the jobs.
This is Common Sense. I'm your co-host, Chase Hageman, along with Paul Steinhauser. We're speaking to former Congressman and Democratic presidential candidate John Delaney. Common Sense is sponsored by Issue One Action and the Warren B. Rudman Center. We'll be back with more from Congressman Delaney after these messages. Welcome back to Common Sense. I'm your co-host, Chase Hageman, along with Paul Steinhauser. We're speaking to former Congressman and Democratic presidential candidate John Delaney. Common Sense is sponsored by Issue One Action and the Warren B. Rudman Center. We've been talking to the congressman a little bit about federal fiscal policy, a lot about infrastructure and climate change plans. And I want to jump back into that a little bit, Congressman. You talked a lot about how you could pay for the plans themselves and the new investments. Federal budget deficits are growing. We've got nearly $1 trillion now, expected to be at $1 trillion within the next couple years, and for the first time in our nation's history, sustained $1 trillion deficits. So my question is, do your plans help shrink the existing deficit? If not, how would you go about trying to do that?
The answer is they don't really shrink the deficit. They slow down the deficit's rate of growth. Because what really matters, Chase, in my opinion, is not the size of the deficit. It's the size of the deficit as a percentage of the economy. So in other words, if we could ever come back, go back to the future or go forward to the future, and if you and I are sitting here in 100 years, $1 trillion deficits wouldn't be a big problem.
Right, and I'll be a floating head on like a robotic
body. Exactly. So it's all about the percentage of the economy. I want the deficits to be 2% as a percentage of the economy. Because if the deficits are 2% and we can grow the economy consistently at 2.5%, then the debt as a percentage of our economy goes down. So my plans involve not so much shrinking the deficit, because I think that would be a very hard thing to do. Sure, if you have good economic times, it happens naturally. But I think through adjustments in tax policy and adjustments in healthcare policy, because healthcare is really the big thing, we're going to get the rate of growth of the deficit under control, and we're going to grow the economy faster. And then we're going to get, in my budget, deficits as a percentage of our economy down to 2%, and then we're fine.
Let's talk about tax reform. You just brought up taxes a second ago. The tax cuts that were passed by Republican Congress.
Yes.
The Trump tax cuts. They definitely helped contribute to the widening of the deficit.
Yes.
No doubt about
Clearly.
That. If you were in the White House, what's your policy? Obviously, I know you didn't agree with the Trump tax cuts.
No, I didn't
but
vote for it.
What would you do?
So I would roll back some of them, mm-hmm. not all of them. I would roll back.
And which ones would you?
I'll tell you. So that's the nice thing about me, Paul. I don't try to duck your questions. You have very good questions. I would roll back the tax cuts on high earners. I would raise the corporate tax the way you and I just and Chase just talked about. Up from 21 up to call it 27%.
Okay.
I'd do that. I would leave the middle income, middle class, lower income tax cuts kind of where they are. I'd like to do some things around the SALT deduction because I think that was a little harsh on some people. But the other thing I would do to raise revenues is I would do what Ronald Reagan did, which I was make the capital gains tax equal to the same rate as the ordinary income tax. The biggest loophole for wealthy people in this country is the fact that they pay much less in tax on their investments than working people pay. And it is the biggest kind of lie, because that's the only word I can use, that has been inflicted on the American people. The notion that wealthy people will not invest unless they have this lower tax credit. That's just not true. I mean, I spent my whole career in business. I spent my life around investments and these kind of things. Wealthy people will invest every single nickel they have unless they're scared of the market, in which case it doesn't matter what the tax rate is. And we have to stop treating wealthy Americans like they're endangered species. Like if it's like the white rhino, like if you do anything to them, they're not going to invest. It's crazy. I have nothing against them. I'm not one of these kind of class warfare Democrats that blames wealthy people for things.
Well, you are one of them.
Yeah. And, I look back at my career that I was been blessed and I've made good money, but I created thousands of jobs and I actually did that stuff. I would have done the exact same thing no matter what the damn tax rate was, because I was wired to want to do that stuff. And the notion that I needed a 20% capital gains rate versus a 32% capital gains rate to do any of that is the most insane thing I've ever heard, and it drives me crazy. And so I agree with Ronald Reagan, who looked out at the American people, because he was the last president where the capital gains rate was the same as the ordinary income rate. And he gave some good speeches about why should people who invest for a living pay more in taxes than folks who work for a living. And Reagan was 100% right. And so people talk about like raising the top marginal rate. You know, all these folks, ALCs out there with the 70%. What these people don't realize is that's not where the money is. The only people who make super high salaries are sports stars and movie stars. Most people who make real money make it off investments. And so if you actually want to do something that's progressive, you close that gap. And again, I'm not doing this because I'm anti them. This is not about vilifying wealthy people. This is just about saying, listen, the joke's over. We all know you should pay the same in tax rate as people who work for a living. Warren Buffett has talked about this for 10 years, how it's insane that his tax rate is lower than his assistants. And he's right. And no one knows more about investing than Warren Buffett and how people think about investing. So that's the big thing I'm going to do to raise them. And it'll be more fair.
So my follow-up to that, Congressman.
Sorry, you can tell this one really gets me.
You're very passionate about it, which is good. We need quality tax reform. My follow-up would be, you talked about keeping middle-income tax rates about the same.
Right.
Would you do anything, and this might actually tie into your health care plan a little bit, would you do anything about tax expenditures, which cost the government between $1.5 and $1.6 trillion in lost revenue?
Yes.
As a result, would that mean you're simplifying the tax code, lowering the rate? What's that look like?
I would make one very, very, very big change on tax expenditures, and I would take away the corporate deductibility of healthcare. So right now there's this weird loophole, and it costs us $4 trillion over 10 years. So it's a big part of the number you're throwing around there, Chase. But if you work for a company and you get healthcare through the company, you don't pay tax on that benefit, but your company gets the deducted. So that kind of combination results in $4 trillion of lost revenues to the government. I want to close that, but I want to give the American people universal health care as part of it. So I want to give every American basic health care as a right, for free, a right of citizenship, a basic plan. But unlike these people advocating for Medicare for All, the single-payer Medicare for All, which is a disaster, because they want to make private insurance illegal, and 150 million Americans have private insurance, and about 100 million of them like it, and including from their company. So I don't want to stop people from doing that, but it'll change a little bit with my plan, which is if you go to work for a company and they offer healthcare, you'll show up with your basic government plan. Think of it like major medical. And if the government wants to give you a better plan with more options, they'll negotiate a group supplemental plan that you'll buy into. You'll turn over basically a tax credit from your government, for the government, that you'll get because you don't use the government plan. And that, together with money the company put chips in or you chip in, will get you basically the same health care you have now. So that's how I want to address creating universal health care. Because having your health care tied to your job through this crazy tax exemption is a bad system.
And correct me if I'm wrong, that's younger than 65.
Yes,
that's your plan.
I leave Medicare alone. That's an important distinction. Medicare works. We should just leave it alone. It's got problems with it, don't get me wrong, but relative
that was my next question.
Relative to the rest of healthcare, I mean, it's it's the top shelf.
So Medicare's trust fund is experiencing issues with the, I believe it's the hospital insurance trust fund,
yeah.
And it's, like you mentioned earlier, heavily supplemented by general revenues.
Never changing.
Right. So what changes would you make to Medicare to either bring the trust fund along so that it's solvent long-term, help reduce that cost curve long term, because you know we have a demographic issue.
Yeah.
You know, we're getting top heavy in programs like that, and it's not inherently bad, but it is something we need to adapt to as well.
Well, you're not going to be able to make it. You're not going to be, unlike Social Security, which can absolutely pay for itself. You can't really get Medicare back to that point. You know, the toothpaste is out of the tube on that, and that's because, listen, that's not a bad thing. We live so much longer, and there's been such extraordinary innovation in healthcare that the Medicare tax payments are just not sized to meet the healthcare needs of our senior. And as a society, we're fine with that. Democrats, Republicans agree that Medicare is a great program and they're fine with the tax dollar subsidizing it. So I don't think that's actually a goal that we should shoot for, because we're not going to get it. But the goal we should shoot for is lowering healthcare costs. And I think we do that with a universal healthcare system. I think we do that by creating incentives for more preventative care, for more telemedicine, for all kinds of smart things that we know lower health care. And the most important thing we got to do is continue to invest in innovation. Like, there's no reason why, if something happens to you or your family and you're at home and you're not sure whether to go to an emergency room, which costs a huge amount of money, that you can't pull out your iPhone and immediately be connected to an emergency room specialist and get a very quick determination as to whether you actually need to go. You know how much money that would save? Like, unbelievable amounts of money. Because so many emergency room visits are unnecessary, but people don't know. And you're like, well, I better go to the emergency room. I mean, I've been there with my kids. I'm sure you guys have been in that situation at some point in your life. And you go to the emergency room and, you know, they tell you you'll be fine. You probably didn't need to come, but it's good you came. And that, meanwhile, we just spent a huge amount of money. Whereas, like, it, sometimes in 2 minutes, connected on your iPhone to an emergency room physician, a whole bunch of them in a big room with technology, they could say, you know, tell me what you got going on. I think you're going to be okay. Just go see your doctor tomorrow. Like, smart stuff like that we got to do. We got to cure Alzheimer's. We got to cure cancer. We got to invest in innovation to lower the cost curve.
Let's go back to Social Security. We brought it up earlier briefly. As you all know, trustees say that the funds will be depleted by 2035. Mm-hmm. The clock is ticking.
Mm-hmm.
So you're in the White House. It's 2021, January of 21. What do you do?
So I call up my buddy Tom Cole, Republican from Oklahoma, who's a great member of Congress. And I say, Tom, you know that bill you and I co-sponsored in the Congress? The only bipartisan bill on Social Security? Well, now that I'm in the White House, it's going to happen. And what Tom Cole and I called for was the creation of a commission that is modeled after the Greenspan Commission, which Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan created in the early 80s when we had the exact same problem. And the Greenspan Commission was 13 folks, like 7 Democrats, 6 Republicans. They went off into a room and they figured out how to extend the solvency of Social Security for 50 years. They made really small adjustments to the, you know, the cap, to the rate of growth of expenses, retirement age, a couple things. And Reagan and Tip O'Neill, to their great insight, agreed to one thing. Whatever that commission comes back with gets a vote on the floor of the Congress. And no one can amend it. So none of these jerks can throw in these poison pill amendments and blow up us fixing Social Security. And it passed. And that's the bill I have with Tom Cole. And we're going to do the same thing when I'm president. We're going to set up a commission. We're going to have 13 people, Democrats and Republicans. They're going to go off in a room. We're going to tell them, hey, you got to extend the solvency of Social Security 75 years. And I'm going to agree with the Speaker of the House and the head of the Senate that whatever they come back with gets a vote, up or down. People don't have to vote for it if they don't want to, but they can't amend it. And again, you and I could fix this thing in 5 minutes.
So piggybacking off of that, and we're running short on time here. We only have a few more minutes. I want to get back to the theme of bipartisanship, because even putting something like that forward would be incredibly difficult. So I get that you'll call up your Republican former colleague, but how do you get broader support for that?
Well, see, one of the things I'm going to do when I'm inaugurated, I want to look out at the American people and tell them I represent every one of them. And the way I'm going to prove it to them is my administration in the first 100 days is going to pick 5 things that are based on existing bipartisan bills in the Congress. And I'm going to say this is what I'm going to champion. I'm not going to jam partisan policies down the throat of the American people. I'm going to actually focus on the things we agree with each other on. I bet 80% of the American people agree that we should do the Social Security Commission. Like, who doesn't think that's a good idea? You know, maybe crazy people on both sides of the aisle in extreme positions don't agree with that because they don't want to work together on anything. But most Americans say, well, that seems pretty reasonable, particularly since none of these changes are going to happen for 15 years because you always set these things up not to kick in for a long time. Or infrastructure, you know, or go down the list. I think there's actually, because I've seen them and I've worked on them, there's some really good bipartisan ideas. The Democrats and Republicans have worked well together. And I think if you said that to the American people, the great center, who used to be called the silent majority, would rise up and say, yeah, we're with you. Let's get government working again. And so you take the case to the American people.
This is Common Sense. I'm your co-host, Chase Hageman, along with Paul Steinhauser. We have been speaking to former Congressman and Democratic presidential candidate John Delaney about national fiscal policy, political process reform, and bipartisanship. Thank you for joining the show.
Thanks for having me.
Common Sense is sponsored by Issue One Action and the Warren B. Rudman Center. We'll be back soon with more 2020 presidential candidate interviews. Thanks for listening.